She scanned the night, a beggar picking the pockets of an unconscious drunkard, a gaunt young man, coiffed and powdered, coaxing a woman through a painted door. Another scream, fainter. They were heading for the river. The feeling crawling up her spine magnified. It felt, she knew no other way to describe it, as though it had a will. She placed her hands on her knees, squeezed her eyes shut. Spots of color danced behind her eyelids. On the battered wooden support beam beside her, someone had scrawled a childish drawing of a masked woman in black, leaping through the air with a knife in each hand. Despite the ill feeling blotting her vision, Eliana couldn't help but grin.
"Oh, for the love of the saints, what are you doing?"
Harkin came up beside her, put a hand on her shoulder. "What's wrong? Are you hurt?"
"Me? Hurt?"
She swallowed hard against the sick feeling tightening her throat.
"Dearest Harkin," she gestured grandly at the drawing of herself. "How could you think such a thing of the dread of Orlean?"
She sprinted away and jumped off the top level of the docks onto another level about 100 feet below. The impact jolted her with only a slight pain. She was up and running again in an instant. Such a fall would break Harkin's legs. He'd have to take the long way down. If Remy were there, he would tell her not to be so obvious.
"People have started to notice," he had told her just the other day. "I hear talk at the bakery."
Eliana, stretching on the floor of her bedroom, had asked innocently,
"What kind of talk?" "When a girl falls 3 stories and then jumps right back to her feet in the middle of the garden square, people tend to notice, especially when she's wearing a cape."
Eliana had smiled at the thought of their gaping, awe-struck faces.
"And what if I want them to notice?"
Remy had been quiet for a long moment. Then,
"Do you want Invictus to come and take you away from me?"
That had silenced her. She'd looked up at her little brother's pale, pinched face and felt her stomach turn over.
"I'm sorry," she told him quietly. "I'm such an ass."
"I don't care if you're an ass," he'd replied.
"Just don't be a show-off."
He was right, she knew. The problem was, she liked showing off. If she was going to be a freak, with a miraculous body that no fool could kill, then she might as well have fun with it. If she was busy having fun, then she didn't have time to wonder why her body could do what it did. And what that meant. Running through the docks, she followed the trail of wrongness in the air like tracking the scent of prey. The dock's lowest level was quiet, the summer air still and damp. She ran around one corner and then another, and stopped. The scent, the feeling, roiled at the edge of this rickety pier. She forced her way forward, even though her churning stomach and every roaring ounce of her blood screamed at her to stay away. 2 figures, masked and wearing dark traveling clothes, waited in a long, sleek boat at the pier's edge. Their tall, blunt builds suggested they were men. A 3rd figure carried a small girl with golden brown skin, like Harkin's. The girl struggled, a gag stuffed in her mouth, her wrists and ankles bound. Red Crown? Unlikely. What would the rebels want with stolen children? And if Red Crown were involved in the abductions, Eliana would have heard whispers from the underground by now. They could be bounty hunters, like herself, but why would the Undying Empire pay for what it could simply take? And working in a group? Very unlikely. One of the figures in the boat held out its arms for the girl. Lumps crowded the boat's floor. Other women, other girls, bound and unconscious. Eliana's anger ignited. She pulled long, thin whistler from her left boot.
"Going somewhere, gentlemen,"
she called and ran at them. The figure on the dock turned just as Eliana reached him. She whirled, caught him with her boot under his chin. He fell, choking. One of the figures from the boat jumped onto the dock. She swiped him across the throat with Arabeth, pushed him into the water after his comrade. She spun around,
triumphant, beckoned at the abductor, still waiting in the boat.
"Come on, love," she crooned. "You're not afraid of me, are you?"
Once, she had flinched at killing. Her first had been 6 years ago, at the age of 12. Rosen Ferracora, Eliana's mother, had brought her along on a job, the last Rosen had taken before her injury, and someone had ratted them out. The rebels had known they were coming. It had been an ambush. Rosen had felled two of them, and Eliana had hidden in the shadows. That had always been her mother's instruction. "I'll keep you from killing as long as I can, sweet girl. For now, watch, learn, practice. What my father taught me, I will teach you." Then one of the rebels had pinned Rosen to the ground, and Eliana had known nothing but rage. She flew at the rebel woman, thrust her little blade deep into the woman's back. Then she stood, staring, as the woman gasped away her life in a pool of blood. Rosen had taken Eliana's hand, hurried her away. Back home in their kitchen, her brother Remy, then only 5, had stared wide-eyed as Eliana's shock gave way to panic. Hands red with blood, she had sobbed herself hoarse in her mother's arms. Luckily, the killing had grown much easier. 2 masked figures darted forward out of the shadows, small bundles in their arms. More girls. They tossed the bundles to their last remaining comrade in the boat, then spun to meet her. She ducked one blow, then another, then took a hard one to the stomach and a sharp hook to the jaw. She stumbled, shook it off. The pain vanished as quickly as it had come. She whirled and stabbed another of the brutes. He toppled into the filthy water. Then a wave of nausea slammed into her, mean as a boot to the gut. She dropped to her knees, gasping for air. A weight settled on her shoulders, fogged her vision, pressed her down hard against the river-slicked dock. 5 seconds. 10. Then the pressure vanished. The air no longer felt misaligned around her body. Her skin no longer crawled. She raised her head, forced open her eyes. The boat was gliding away. Wild with anger, head still spinning, Eliana staggered to her feet. A strong arm came around her middle, pulling her backward just as she prepared to dive.
"Get off me," she said tightly, "or I'll get nasty."
She elbowed Harkin in his ribs. He swore, but didn't let go. "El, have you lost your mind? This isn't the job."
"They took her."
She stomped on his instep, twisted out of his grip, ran back to the dock's edge. He followed and caught her arm, spun her around to face him.
"It doesn't matter. This isn't the job."
Her grin emerged hard as glass.
"When has restraining me ever worked out in your favor?"
"Oh, wait," she sidled closer, softened her smile.
"I can think of a time or two."
"Stop it, El. What have you always told me?" His dark eyes found hers, locked on.
"If it isn't the job, it isn't our problem."
Her smile faded. She yanked her arm away from him.
"They keep taking us. Why? And who are they? Why only the girls? What was that? That feeling? I've never felt anything like that before."
He looked dubious.
"Maybe you need to sleep."
She hesitated, despair creeping slowly in.
"You felt nothing at all?"
"Sorry. No." She glared at him, ignoring the unsettled feeling in her gut.
"Well, even so, that girl was no rebel. She was a child. Why would they bother taking her?"
"Whatever the reason, it's not our problem," Harkin repeated. He took a long, slow breath, perhaps convincing himself.
"Not tonight. We have work to do."
Eliana stared out at the river for a long time. She imagined carving a face into a slab of flawless stone. No sweat, no scars. Only a hard smile that would come when called, and eyes like knives at night. By the time she had finished, her anger had faded, and the unfeeling face was her own. She turned to Harkin, brought out the cheeky little grin he despised.
"Shall we, then? Those bastards worked up my appetite."
The Red Crown rebel smuggler known as Quill snuck both people and information out of Orlene. He was good at it, too. One of the best. It had taken weeks for Eliana and Harkin to track him down. Now they crouched on a roof overlooking a tiny courtyard in the old quarter, where Quill was supposed to meet a group of rebel sympathizers trying to flee the city. The courtyard reeked sweetly from the roses lining the walls. Beside her, Harkin shifted, alert. Eliana watched dark shapes enter the courtyard and crowd together in the corner below a climbing rosebush, waiting. Not long after, a hooded figure entered from the opposite corner and approached them. Eliana curled her fingers around her dagger, her blood racing. The clouds shifted, moonlight washed the yard clean. Eliana's heart stuttered and sank. Quill. It had to be him. There was the faint limp in his gait from a wound sustained during the invasion. And there, waiting for him, were a woman and three small children. Harkin swore under his breath. He pointed at the children, signed with his hand. He and Eliana had engineered a silent code years ago, when she first started hunting alone after Rosen's injury. He had insisted she not go by herself, and so he had learned to hunt and track, to kill, to turn on their own people and serve the Empire instead, all for her. "No," came his message. "Abort." She knew what he meant. The children weren't part of this job. Quill was one thing, but the idea of handing innocent children over to the Lord of Orlene, it wouldn't sit well with Harkin. Honestly, it didn't with Eliana either. But three rebels waited at the courtyard's shadowed entrance, Quill's escort and protectors. There was no time, and it was too big a risk to spare the family. She and Harkin had to move quickly. She shook her head.
"Take them,"
she signed back. Harkin drew a too loud breath. She heard the furious sadness in it. Below, Quill's head whipped toward them. Eliana jumped off the roof, landed lightly, rolled to her feet, thought briefly how it was a terrible shame that she couldn't sit back and watch herself fight. Surely it looked as good as it felt. Quill drew a dagger. The mother fell to her knees, begging for mercy. Quill pushed his hood back, middle-aged, ruddy-faced, and intelligent in the eyes. He had a serenity to him that said, "I fear not death, but surrender." 4 seconds later, Eliana had kicked his bad leg out from under him, relieved him of his knife, struck the back of his head with the hilt. He did not rise again. She heard Harkin land behind her, followed by rapid footsteps as the other rebels rushed into the courtyard. Together, she and Harkin had them down in moments. She whirled and flung her dagger. It hit the wooden courtyard door, trapping the eldest child in place by his cloak. The others froze and burst into tears. Their mother lay glassy-eyed on the ground in a bed of rotting petals. One of the rebels' daggers protruded from her heart. Eliana yanked it free, another blade for her arsenal. She wondered why the rebels had killed the woman. To protect themselves? Or to grant her mercy they knew she would not otherwise receive?
"Fetch the guard,"
Eliana ordered, searching the mother for valuables. She found nothing except for a small idol of the Emperor, crafted from mud and sticks, no doubt kept on her person in case an Adatrox patrol stopped her for a search. The idol's beady black eyes glittered in the moonlight. She tossed it aside. The children's sobs grew louder.
"I'll stay with them."
Harkin paused, that sad, tired look on his face that made her hackles rise because she knew he hoped it would change her one of these days. Make her better. Make her good again. She lifted an eyebrow. "Sorry, Harkin. Good girls don't live long." Then he left. The eldest child watched Eliana, arms around his siblings. Some impulse stirring deep inside her urged her to let them go, just this once. It wouldn't hurt anything. They were children. They were nothing. But children couldn't keep their mouths shut, and if anyone ever found out that the dread of Orlean, Lord Arkelian's pet huntress, had let traitors run free.
"We were afraid the bad men would take her too," the boy said simply. "That's why we wanted to leave."
The bad men. A tiny chill skipped up Eliana's neck. The masked men from the docks. But the boy said no more than that. He did not even try to run. Smart boy, Eliana thought. He knew he would not get far. The next afternoon, Eliana stood on a balcony overlooking the gallows. Lord Arkelian lounged at the east end of the square, the high back of his throne carved to resemble wings. Eliana, watching him, folded her arms across her chest, shifted her weight to one hip, tried to ignore the figure standing in a red and black Invictus uniform beside his lordship's throne. From this height, Eliana couldn't tell who it was, but it didn't matter. The mere sight of that familiar silhouette was enough to turn her stomach. Invictus, a company of assassins that travelled the world and carried out the Emperor's bidding. The most dangerous jobs, the bloodiest jobs. It was only a matter of time before they recruited her. She imagined it daily, just to see if the idea would ever stop terrifying her. So far, it hadn't. Probably Ruzzavel would be the one to come for her. Eliana had seen him at a handful of his lordship's parties over the years. Each time he had requested a dance with her. Each time his flat grey gaze had dared her to refuse him. Oh, how she'd wished she could have.
"An invincible bounty hunter," he had crooned in her ear during their last dance together the previous summer. "How curious."
He had threaded his cold fingers through hers.
"You'll make a fine addition to our family some day."
When Ruzzavel came for her, he probably wouldn't even let her say goodbye to her loved ones before escorting her overseas to Seldaria, the heart of the Undying Empire, and to the Emperor himself.
"Welcome, Eliana Ferrocora," the Emperor said in her most awful dreams, his smile not reaching his black eyes. "I've heard so much about you."
And that would be the end of life as she now knew it. She would become one of the elite, a soldier of Invictus. She would become like Ruzzavel, a new breed of monster. Today, however, was not that day. So Eliana watched, tapping her fingers against her arm, wishing his lordship would get it over with. She was hungry and tired, and Harkin was beside himself with shame. And the longer they stood there, the more desperately he would expect something from her that she couldn't give him. Regret. The Empire Guard marched Quill and the eldest child up to the gallows. It had been constructed in the ruins of the temple of Saint Marzana, the revered firebrand of the old world, the world before the Blood Queen Riel had died, before the rise of the Empire. Empire soldiers had almost entirely demolished the temple when they seized Orlean. Once the temple had been a grand array of domed halls, classrooms and sanctuaries open to the river breeze, and courtyards draped in blossoming vines. Now, only a few crumbling pillars remained. Saint Marzana's statue, standing guard at the temple entrance, had been destroyed. A likeness of the Emperor now loomed there instead, his features masked, his body cloaked. Gold, black, and crimson banners flanked his head. The plaza beneath him was crowded but quiet. The citizens of Orlean were used to executions, but Quill was popular in certain circles, and not even his lordship often slaughtered children. When Eliana and Harkin had presented the captive children to him, Lord Arkelian had smiled kindly, inspected the younger one's teeth, and sent them off with one of his mistresses. The children had reached back for their brother, wailing all the way down the throne room until someone had, blessedly, shut the doors. But the eldest child had not cried, and he was not crying today, not even as he watched the executioner raise his sword.
"The Empire will burn!" shouted Quill, his hair plastered to his scalp with sweat. The sword fell. Quill's head rolled. An uneasy wave of sound swept through the crowd. Only then, his face splattered with fresh blood, did the boy start to cry.
"Ew!" Harkin choked out. He took Eliana's hand in his sweaty one, rubbed his thumb along her palm. His voice came out frayed. He had not slept. She had slept like the dead. Sleep was important. One could not hunt without a good night's sleep. "We don't have to watch," she told him as patiently as she could manage. "We can go." He released her hand.
"You can go if you want. I have to watch."
There it was again, that same exhausted tone, like a sad-eyed hound resigned to its next beating. To keep from snapping at him, Eliana fiddled with the batter's gold pendant under her cloak. She wore it on a chain around her neck every day, and knew the scratched, worn lines of it by heart. The arch of the horse's neck, the intricate details of its wings, the figure riding astride it, sword raised, face blackened from time. Audric, the Lightbringer. One of the dead old world kings her brother obsessed over for reasons Eliana couldn't fathom. Her parents told her they had found the trinket on the street when Eliana was still a baby, and given it to her to calm her crying one sleepless night. She had worn it for as long as she could remember, though not out of love for the Lightbringer. She cared nothing for dead kings. No, she wore it because some days she felt like the familiar weight of the necklace at her throat was the only thing that kept her from flying apart.
"I'll stay," she told Harkin lightly.
Too lightly? Probably.
"I've got the time."
He didn't even scold her. The executioner lifted his sword. At the last moment, the child raised his hand in a salute, a fist at his heart, and then held up in the air. The sign of allegiance to the rebellion, to Red Crown. His arm shook, but he stared at the sun with unblinking eyes. He began reciting the Sun Queen's prayer.
"May the Queen's light guide me!"
The sword fell. Eliana's tears surprised her. She blinked them away before they could fall. Harkin covered his mouth with one hand.
"God help us," he whispered.
"Oh,
what are we doing?"
She grasped his hand, made him face her.
"Surviving," she told him. "And that's nothing to be ashamed of."
She swallowed and swallowed again. Her jaw ached, pretending boredom was hard work, but so was war. And if she fell to pieces, Harkin would crumble even faster. The Lord of Orleans raised one hand. The citizens packed into the plaza below chanted the words that constantly circled through Eliana's mind, like carrion birds.
"Glory to the Empire! Glory to the Empire! Glory to the Empire!"
Chapter 3. Riel.
After the breaking of the Sunderlands, the Seven returned to the mainland, and still they could not rest. Their people had been at war for decades, and they craved a safe place to call home. So the Saints began in Catel's homeland and use their power to carve out of the Alpine Mountains a paradise. Sheltered by high peaks, verdant with forests and farmlands, this haven was named Arme de la Terre and became the capital of Seldaria. They built the Queen City in the foothills of the highest mountain and surrounded it with a crystal lake that seemed carved out of the clearest sky.
A Concise History of the Second Age, Volume 1. The Aftermath of the Angelic Wars by Daniel Riveray and Jeanette D'Argembeau. Of the First Guild of Scholars. The starting line was chaos. Some riders competed in the name of the church temples. Those from the pyre, Tal's temple, wore scarlet and gold. Black and deep blue for the House of Night, the temple of Shadowcasters and Tal's sister, Sloane. Umber and light green for the Holdfast, the Earthshaker temple. The great Seldarian houses had also sent representatives. Riel passed riders in lilac and sage for House Riveray, russet and steel for House Sevillier. Riders had even travelled from the distant kingdoms of Venterra and Astavar, which lay across the great ocean. Many riders, like Riel, had been hired by merchants eager for the winning purse, though none of them were as wealthy as her sponsor, Odo La Roche. And none of the other riders had had the privilege of training with the king's finest horse masters since they were old enough to sit in a saddle. Grinning, Riel guided her mare beneath the maze of stilted spectator boxes. Her ears rang from the noise, gamblers shouting their bets, children racing through the crowd and shrieking with delight. Smoke from market vendors selling roasted pork sandwiches and blackened fowl skewers stung her eyes. She finally reached the tent set aside for Odo's riders. The gown she wore was a favorite, forest green to match her eyes, iridescent vines sewn at the hem, a swooping neckline that showed off her collarbones. But the midday sun made her itch to rip it off. Leaving her horse with the paid swords guarding the door, she slipped inside to change. And froze. Audric was already there, clad in only his riding trousers and boots. His fine emerald tunic and embroidered jacket hung neatly from the back of a chair. In his hands, he held a plain linen riding shirt. He grinned at her.
"Took you long enough," he said,
and threw her a shirt of her own. She caught it barely. "The crowds are larger than I had anticipated," she said, though her throat was suddenly dry, and it astonished her that she could manage a word. It had been a long time since she had seen her kingdom's prince so unclothed. Growing up together, it would have meant nothing. She had spent hours playing with him and Ludovine in the gardens behind the castle. They had swum together in the lake surrounding the city, worshipped together at the baths. But that had been before. Before Audric and Ludovine's betrothal, an arrangement that bound the houses of Corvery and Sauvillier even closer together. Before Audric had transformed from her shy, gangly, awkward friend into Prince Audric, the Lightbringer, the most powerful sunspinner in centuries. Before Riel had realized she loved Audric and that he would never be hers. She drank in the sight of him, the lean muscles of his arms, his broad chest, his narrow waist. He was not as dark as his father, not as pale as his mother, the queen. Dark brown curls, damp from the heat, loosely framed his face. Dappled sunlight fell through the tent's netting and painted his skin radiant. When he looked up at her, she flushed at the warmth of his gaze.
"Lou's all right?" he asked.
"And enjoying the attention, I'm sure. And your mother?"
"I told her I'd take care of Lou, and that she should relax and enjoy the race."
He shook his head ruefully.
"She thinks I'm a dutiful son."
"And instead you're sneaking off to risk life and limb," Riel threw him a sly smile. "Your lie was a kindness. She'd be frantic if she knew where you really were."
Audric laughed. Mother could use a fright now and then. Otherwise she gets bored, and when she gets bored, she starts to meddle. And when she meddles, she starts pestering me and Lou.
About when we will be wed, the unsaid words lingered, and Riel could no longer look at him.
She stepped behind the dressing screen Odo had provided, undid her gown, stepped out of it. Clothed in only her shift, she reached for the trousers Audric tossed over to her.
If I didn't know better, she said, keeping her voice light, I'd say you're sounding rather rebellious. And here I thought you weren't one for breaking rules.
He laughed again. You bring it out of me.
This was, she began to realize, a terrible idea. She should have asked Odo for a separate tent. Undressing 5 feet away from Audric was the sort of delicious madness for which she could never have prepared herself. God help her. She could hear the fabric of his riding tunic sliding against his torso. She could almost feel it, as if he were there beside her, drawing her gown up over her head, freeing her of the last remaining barrier between them. As she tried to wriggle into her own black tunic, cursing herself and her unhelpfully vivid imagination, she got her arms stuck through the heavy embroidered collar.
Riel, came Audric's voice. Hurry! They've started announcing the races!
Damn, damn, damn! Riel twisted and squirmed, tugging at her shirt. On the other side of the screen, the tent flap opened.
The race is starting, and it seems my two riders are nowhere to be found, came Odo's smooth baritone, with only a touch of irritation. May I remind you that I'm wagering quite a bit of coin on both of you, as well as my own head, should either of you be stupid enough to be discovered, or worse, break your necks.
We'll be right there, Riel called. Have I ever given you reason to doubt me?
On numerous occasions, in fact,
Odo replied. There was a pause.
Shall I enumerate them for you?
One moment, please, Odo, Audric said, laughter in his voice. The tent flap closed.
Can I come around? Audric called.
Yes, but, oh, hang on! With a violent twist, Riel managed to free herself. She jerked down the tunic, fumbling with the gold ribbons at the neckline. Yes, all right, I'm decent.
Audric rounded the screen, her leather riding jacket and cap in hand.
Could it be that we're about to sneak into this life-threatening race, and you're the flustered one? Never mind that you tried to get out of doing this a dozen times.
Riel yanked her cap from his hand.
Never mind that you haven't broken a rule in your life before now.
But what an inaugural defiance it is. Don't you agree?
He moved closer to help her fasten the tunic's clasp between her shoulders. His fingers grazed the nape of her neck.
I mean, I could have begun my rebellious streak with something simple. Being late to morning court, skipping my prayers, bedding a servant girl.
She burst out laughing. It sounded shriller than she would have liked.
You? Bed a servant girl? You don't know the first thing about courting a woman.
So you think?
I don't believe it.
Am I that hopeless a case to you?
To start, you'd have to put down your books every now and then.
Lady Riel, came his teasing voice. Are you offering to educate me in the art of seducing a woman?
A terrible silence fell. Riel felt Audric tense behind her. A blush crept up her cheeks. Why had she let herself get drawn into this, of all conversations? She knew nothing about courting anyone. Her father had made sure of that. Once at 13, Riel had come home after watching 15-year-old Audric practice his sword work in the barracks yard, feeling on edge and ready to burst out of her skin. Her father and his lieutenants had run Audric through many drills that day. Magister Guillory sat nearby, offering advice whenever she saw fit. As Grand Magister of the House of Light, the ferocious old woman had overseen Audric's sunspinner studies for years. She and Riel's father had helped Audric focus the sometimes overwhelming call of his power into the physical, reliable work of fighting with a sword. Riel had watched many of Audric's practices, but that particular one
had been different. She had not been able to get him out of her head afterward. How he'd moved in the afternoon light, every motion steady and sure, brow furrowed in concentration as his sword scattered flares of sunlight across his skin. She had brought her father his customary drink after dinner that night, and been so rattled that she dropped the cup. Her father had raised an eyebrow.
"You're not yourself tonight."
She had said nothing, unsure of how to answer him.
"I noticed you in the yard today," he observed mildly. "You've been coming around often of late."
Riel crouched to sweep up the mess, her hair hiding her hot face. Then her father had pulled her to her feet, hard enough to hurt her wrist.
"I know what you're thinking," he had told her, "and I forbid it. You might lose control one day and hurt him. He has a rare gift, do you understand? The most power anyone has had in half an age. It's important for the realm to see that he is master of it, not the other way around. The last thing Audric needs is someone like you hovering about."
Riel's eyes had filled with tears. "Someone like me?" Her father had released her, impassive.
"A murderer."
Lord Commander Dardenne had not allowed his daughter to attend Audric's practices after that. Now, at 18, Riel had not kissed a soul, nor come close to it. Certainly, she had imagined it, and often. She knew she was beautiful, if not in the conventional sense, then in the way that at least made people look, and look hard. Striking was the word Ludovine often used, or arresting. Her father had only once commented on her looks.
"You have the face of a liar. I can see all the machinations of the world in your eyes."
Nevertheless, Riel cultivated this beauty however she could, dressing in the most outlandish fashions she could get away with, bold and just shy of revealing, crafted from exotic fabrics that Ludovine secretly ordered for her and that made her stand out at court like a peacock among pigeons. Every time she had dared to show herself in such a garment, she had sensed hungry gazes upon her and felt her own secret hunger rear up inside her belly, hot and eager. But even then, her father's words hung about her neck like a yoke of thorns, and she tamped down every voracious instinct she possessed. Besides, she didn't want just anyone. Not enough to take the risk. So she kept herself apart, her frustrations manifesting in slick and frantic dreams, sometimes of Audric, sometimes of Ludovine, or Tal. Mostly of Audric. After those nights, when Dream Audric had drawn her into his bed, she would wake to find the mirrors in her room cracked, once extinguished candles freshly lit and sputtering. Her father was not wrong. There was a danger to her, an unpredictability. She would not bring that to someone else's bed, especially not someone who had been promised to her friend. Riel made the mistake of looking at Audric over her shoulder, and his dark gaze locked onto hers for a brief moment before they both looked away.
"We should go," she said.
She grabbed her jacket from his hands, twisted her hair up into her riding cap, and went outside to mount her horse. She wrapped her cap's veil about her neck and face, tucked the end of it into her collar. When Audric joined her, wearing his own protective coverings, they did not speak, and she was glad. This race would not be kind to her if she remained distracted. Together, they followed the other riders to the starting line. Audric rode one of Odo's horses, a chestnut Saldarian mare from the southern Riverlands. Riel's own mount, another from Odo's stables, was smaller, a grey Kyrvian mare named Malia, who held her banner tail high. Riel took her place at the starting line, 5 slots to the left and 2 behind Audric. The herald, high overhead, announced each racer through a small round amplifier engineered at the forge. When Riel heard her own false name announced, she waved to the crowd to generous applause. Though her and Audric's assumed identities meant nothing to these people, the name of their sponsor, the wealthy merchant Odo LaRoche, who owned half the city's businesses, carried tremendous weight. High overhead, King Bastian took his place before the amplifier to begin the opening remarks.
"To celebrate another year of peace in our kingdom," the king's voice boomed, "and in hopes for a bountiful harvest and a joyous festival, and to give thanks to God who has blessed Seldaria with such gifts, I welcome all of you to this year's Boon Chase."
King Bastian returned to his seat, and the drummers began. The lines of racers shifted, the air crackled against Riel's skin. The race heralds blew on their horns once, twice. Riel curled her gloved fingers around Malia's reins, every inch of her body thrumming. The final racers took their place, 12 masked arbiters in the royal colours of plum, emerald, and gold. They would run the course and watch for foul play. The drumbeats accelerated, matching Riel's pounding heart. The heralds blew their horns a third time. With a deafening roar from the crowd, the racers plunged forward onto the flats, the wide stretch of grasslands outside the city gates. The chase had begun. The first few minutes were a blinding frenzy of sound and color. The hooves of 5 dozen horses kicked up clouds of dust. To Riel's right, a man with a metal guard over his teeth yanked on a spiked glove and knocked another racer off his mount with a thrust of one meaty arm. The other racers trampled him, cutting off his screams, and his horse left the course with its reins trailing. Riel drove Malia forward, looking around wildly. An arbiter should have disqualified the man for that, but in the storm of dust, she couldn't pick out the arbiter's colors. It was as though they had vanished. She crossed the flats, guiding Malia through a throng of shoving elbows and flying whips. Racers shouting at their mounts to move and yelling threats in a dozen languages. When she reached the foothills of Mount Talea, she slowed her pace and directed Malia up the steeper forested climb. She saw a flash of familiar color through the trees ahead, black and gold, Odo's colors. Audric. She lowered herself against Malia's neck, urged her mare up the foothills, and emerged out of the trees into the first mountain paths. A broad stretch of grass shivered in the wind before her. Walls of rock towered on either side. Riel's heart lifted. She murmured the Kivayan words Odo had told her the mare would respond to. "Ride the wind, falcon of my blood, wings of my heart." Malia shot forward. The wind whipped past them, ripping tears from Riel's eyes. She caught up to Audric and crowed with triumph. He glanced her way, his scarf falling loose. He grinned at her, and her heart leapt. Despite the danger of the race, she couldn't help but wish they could stay out here, away from court, away from everyone else. Forever. Seconds later, Audric veered away, taking the shortest path around the mountain. His Seldarian mare was bred for such steep, rocky trails. But Malia was built for speed. Riel pushed her on across the pass, and Malia obeyed. The wind howled in Riel's ears. She could hardly hear herself breathe. The shapes of the other riders fanning out across the pass were blurs of color. They were catching up to her. She turned Malia right onto a narrow cliffside trail. Not her first choice, but it would give her better time. She told herself not to look and yet couldn't help it, peering over the edge into the chasm below. She broke out in sick chills, her vision tilted. One wrong shift of her weight, one misstep from her horse, and she'd fly to her death. Behind her came a clatter of hooves and rock. When the cliff trail widened, sloping down into the wooded foothills, she looked back. One racer zipped by her, and then three more, so close she could smell their sweat. Behind them, a racer rammed his horse into the side of another, knocking both horse and rider off the cliff Riel had just travelled. The fallen horse let out a terrible scream, then fell silent. Riel turned away, heart pounding, eyes stinging from the dust clogging the air. She exited the woods near the trail to the second pass that would bring her around Mount Talea and back toward the city. There, she found arbiters at last, seven of them, some distance ahead of her. They had thrown off their masks, letting their blonde, braided hair fly free. They were letting out shrill war cries that Riel recognized at once from one of Audric's interminable lectures about Borsvar. They were closing in on the rider nearest them, a man in black and gold, his cap and scarf fallen free, the wind ripping through his dark curls. The world distilled to this single, terrible moment. Dread knocked the wind from Riel's lungs. The arbiters, whoever they were no soldiers of her father's. They were from Borsvar, and they were surrounding Audric with their swords raised to kill.
Chapter 4 Eliana. But when the Empire forces came to Orlean, the capital of Venterra, they were struck blind by a brilliant light. It was the Sun Queen, glittering and vengeful. She led the charge with King Maximilian at her side, and everyone she touched felt their long-forgotten magic awaken. They were sunspinners once more, firebrands and earthshakers, and the river that morning ran red with Empire blood. The Sun Queen's triumph, being an alternative history of the Kingdom of Venterra, as written in the Journal of Remy Ferrocora, June 14th, year 1018 of the Third Age. After the executions, Eliana saw Harkin home to his tiny apartment on the top floor of the building next to her own. As she turned to go, he said softly, "El?" She hesitated. If she stayed, they would share his bed, as they often did. His touch would be absolution. His strong brown arms, the tender way he held her after and stroked her hair. For a little while, she would forget who she was and what she had done. But then Harkon would want to talk. He would look into her eyes and search for the girl she had once been. The thought exhausted her. "Please, El," Harkon said, his voice strained. "I need you." He could hardly look at her. Was he embarrassed that he didn't want to be alone, or ashamed to crave the touch of a monster? Unbidden, a memory surfaced, the boy's defiant, tear-streaked face just before the executioner's sword fell. Eliana's stomach clenched. She squeezed Harkin's hand. "All right, but I just want to sleep." His voice came gently. "Me too." They climbed through the terrace window and into his room, plain and small, strewn with rumpled clothes. The rest of his family's apartment remained silent and shuttered. Since his mother and older brothers had died at the wall the day the Empire invaded 10 years earlier, Harkon had not touched any of their things, or sat in furniture they had sat in, or used his mother's pots and pans. The apartment was a tomb, and Eliana dared not enter it for fear of breathing ghosts into her body. But Harkon's bedroom was a familiar, untidy place. Over the years, Eliana had spent as many nights there as she had in her own. She climbed into his bed, waiting. He pulled the drapes nearly shut, leaving the window open behind them. He lit the 4 squat candles he kept on a side table, one for each member of his lost family.
When he had pulled off his shirt and boots, he climbed in beside her and drew her down into the warm nest of his arms.
"Thank you," he murmured against her cheek.
She smiled, wriggling closer.
"I always sleep better when I'm with you."
He laughed softly. Then the room filled with silence. He worried the ends of her braid between his fingers.
"Someday, we'll have enough money to leave this place."
Eliana closed her eyes. It was the beginning of Harkin's favorite story, one he had told her countless times. She didn't have the heart to tell him she couldn't stand listening to it. Not today. That this story had been a comfort when they were young and didn't know any better, but was simply cruel and pointless now. So she waited until she could speak instead of yelling at him, and asked, as she always did, "Where will we go?"
"North, across the narrow sea, to Astavar."
Astavar. Eliana used to dream about what it would look like. White-capped mountains, lush green valleys, a world of ice and snow, and night skies filled with twisting strands of colored light. Now it was simply a place on a map, Ventera's northern neighbor and the last free country left in the world.
"No one gets in or out of Astavar,"
Eliana countered, falling into the rhythm of their practiced back and forth.
"We'll find a smuggler," Harkin continued.
"A good one. We'll pay whatever we need to pay."
"Astavar will fall one of these days. Everyone falls to the Empire. Look what happened to us."
"Perhaps. But in the meantime, we could have a few years of peace. You, me, your mother, Remy."
He squeezed her hand.
"A proper family."
Just like the one Eliana had destroyed mere hours ago. Suddenly she found it difficult to swallow. Suddenly her eyes felt hot and full. Damn it, this was what came of trying to be a good friend.
"I don't know that I could ever be proper," she teased. It sounded unconvincing even to her.
"Think of it, El."
Harkin's thumb smoothed circles against the crook of her arm.
"The sea isn't large. We could be in Astavar in an hour, maybe two. We could find a small place, maybe by a lake. I could farm, Remy could bake, your mother could continue with her mending, and you and me."
Eliana sat up. She couldn't play this game any longer.
"If we could get past the Empire troops at our border, and if we could find a smuggler who wouldn't betray us to the Empire, and if we could convince the Astavaris to let us cross their border, if we managed to do all that with money we don't have, what would I do then, in this fantasy of yours?"
Harkin ignored the harsh edge to her voice. He kissed her wrist.
"Anything. You can hunt game. I'll teach you how to grow tomatoes. You can wear a straw hat."
He pressed his lips to her shoulder.
"I suppose you don't have to wear a hat. Although I'm not ashamed to say I've been daydreaming about it for so long that my heart might break if you didn't."
"It won't work," she said at last.
"The hat?"
Harkin's gaze was soft.
"On the contrary, I think it would flatter you nicely."
In that moment, she hated him almost as much as she hated herself. She moved out of his arms, drew her tunic over her head, and gently pinned his wrists to his pillow.
"There's no place for a girl like me in your dream world, love," she explained with a coy smile. "All I know how to do is kill. Remember?"
"And this," Harkin said, his eyes dark and his voice low.
"And this," she agreed, and then kissed him deeply enough that he had nothing else to say.
That evening, she returned home at dusk to prepare dinner.
"Darling mother,"
she dropped a kiss on her mother's cheek.
"What happened today?"
asked Rosen Ferracora. She sat at the table, parts from her latest tinkering job scattered across the worn wood, nuts and bolts, nails and knives.
I heard about the boy. And Quill. Oh? Did you?
Eliana shrugged, started chopping carrots. She felt her mother's eyes upon her, and chopped faster.
Well, what do you expect? Another banner day in the glorious kingdom of Venterra.
Later, Remy came in and sat at the table, watching Eliana lay out their dinner. A loaf of fresh bread, vegetable stew, a block of hard cheese, all of it high quality, freshly bought in the garden quarter. Eliana had never been more aware of their lovely little home, their stock of food, the relative safety of their neighborhood. All of it bought with the blood on her hands. She filled her mother's bowl and set it before her with a flourish. Remy broke the silence, his voice shaking. His blue eyes were brilliant with unshed tears.
You're a coward.
Eliana had expected that. Still, the vitriol in his voice was a gut punch. She almost dropped her plate. Rosen hissed at him.
Stop it, Remy. I heard a child was executed today, and that rebel Quill, the one who smuggles people out of the city.
Eliana's throat tightened painfully. She had never seen such an expression on Remy's face, like he didn't recognize her, and didn't want to. With relish, she bit off a chunk of bread.
All true.
You did that, he whispered.
Did what? You killed them.
She swallowed, knocked back a gulp of water, wiped her mouth.
As I've said before, my cowardice keeps us warm and fed and alive. So, dearest brother, unless you'd prefer to starve.
Remy shoved his plate away.
I hate you.
Rosen sat rigid in her chair.
You don't. Don't say that.
Let him hate me.
Eliana glanced at Remy and then quickly away. He was looking right at the soft hole in her middle, this hollow place she let no one but him see. It ached from the bruise of his words.
If it helps him sleep at night, he can hate me until the end of his days.
Remy's eyes flicked to her neck, where the chain of her necklace was visible. His expression darkened.
You wear King Audric the Lightbringer around your neck, but you don't deserve to.
His gaze traveled back to her face.
He'd be ashamed of you if the Blood Queen hadn't killed him. He'd be ashamed of anyone who helps the Empire.
If the Blood Queen hadn't killed him, Eliana said evenly, then it wouldn't matter, would it? Maybe the Empire would never have risen. Maybe we'd all be living in a world full of magic and flying horses and beautiful castles built by the saints themselves.
She clasped her hands, regarded him with exaggerated patience.
But Queen Riel did kill him, and so here we are, and I wear his image around my neck to remind myself that we don't live in that world. We live in a world where good kings die, and those foolish enough to hope for something better are killed where they stand.
She ignored them both after that, and devoured her stew in silence. Her mother found her later that night, when Eliana was cleaning her blades in her room.
Eliana, said Rosen, panting slightly, you should rest.
Even with her prosthetic leg, it took her some effort to get upstairs unassisted. She leaned hard on her cane.
Mother, what are you doing?
Eliana rose, helped her to sit. Her daggers and smoke grenades lay across the floor, a tapestry of death.
You should be the one resting.
Rosen stared at the floor for a long moment. Then her face crumpled, and she turned into Eliana's shoulder.
I hate seeing you like this, she whispered. I'm sorry for this. I'm sorry I taught you. I'm sorry for everything.
Eliana held on to her, stroking her messy knot of dark hair. She listened to Rosen whisper too many apologies to count.
Sorry about what?
Eliana said at last.
That grandfather taught you how to kill. That you taught me.
Rosen cupped Eliana's cheek in one weathered hand, searched her face with wet eyes that reminded Eliana of Remy's.
Inquisitive.
Tireless.
You tell me if you needed a rest.
We can ask Lord Arkellion for time.
Time for what?
to bake cookies and paint the walls a fresh color.
Eliana smiled, squeezed her mother's hand.
I wouldn't know what to do with myself.
Rosen's mouth thinned.
Eliana,